Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 8. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is the 2012 Mem Part 2, an interview with John Major Jenkins. In our continuing investigation into the modern phenomena of the 2012 New Age movement, I'm bringing John Major Jenkins on to discuss his own work in Myocosmogenesis 2012. Last month in podcast number 4, the 2012 Mem Part 1, I interviewed Professor John Hupps from the University of Kansas, who refuted the majority of the 2012 movement. However, Hupps separated Jenkins' work out apart from the others in the 2012 movement, the other so-called researchers, as Jenkins' work being sort of far above the others, and asked Jenkins to publish a lot of his findings academically. So this episode is Jenkins' chance to rebut some of the criticisms that Hupps gave against his work, as well as throw in some of his own criticisms against the 2012 movement. So it's a very good episode. I hope you'll stay tuned. I should mention that at the end of the show there is an addendum of 13 minutes. Jenkins had contacted me after the initial interview, and we had realized that there were a couple questions that we had forgot to cover during the original interview, so those are at the end. So when you hear us saying goodbye at the end of the show is not quite over. It'll start right back up right after that with Jenkins commenting on two more of John Hupps' criticisms, so don't miss that. On December 20th at 6:30 p.m. in Huntington Beach, I will be giving another presentation, and the topic of discussion will be the Christmas solstice celebrations. Seating is limited. We ask that you RSVP in advance. There will be a $15 charge at the door. Donations. I'd like to thank Tiffany, Matthew, David, Graham, Gare, and Mark for their very kind and generous donations. Mark donated $3.50, and I'd like to especially mention that because Mark sent me a personal note saying that he didn't have a lot of money, but he really appreciated the show and wanted to at least support a little bit, and I really appreciate his donation. I, including other podcasters like Martin Ball, have asked for even as little as a dollar per episode from people to help support the podcast. And, you know, it's very time-consuming to do this, and it's very helpful if you can donate whatever you can. And the show is approaching 17,000 to 18,000 listeners, and if I had 20% of you donate a dollar a week for the episode, that would enable us to do some pretty phenomenal shows and video and other projects as well. So anyway, I appreciate the donations. David also offered to donate some sound equipment, so thank you, David. That should help increase the quality of the shows dramatically. We still need camera equipment if anybody out there can help with that. This show is free of charge, listener sponsored. It's not corporate media. You decide what you want to listen to, so please help with whatever you can. I don't get rich from the book sales or anything like that. They do pay some of the bills, but certainly not all of them. So all of your help is greatly appreciated. And as well, let's see, if anybody would like a book or DVD as a gift or anything like that, I can get those out still on time for Christmas, I believe. If you get your order in by Monday or Tuesday or possibly Wednesday this week, I should be able to get that to you in time for the holidays. And Amazon is also offering the Holy Mushroom now at a discounted rate of $33.48. If those of you who are not interested in getting a numbered signed copy of my new book, The Holy Mushroom, you can get that directly from Amazon now. And Amazon, as always, has a very discounted price on that. So check it out there. And I'd also like to mention that I did have some microphone issues recently, so they're sort of sorted out, but I apologize for my microphone quality sounding different throughout this show. There were a couple different microphones used, one had failed, so that's why. And let's see, upcoming podcasts. We've got James DeMeo on December 15th, Rick Doblin from MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, coming on December 22nd. John Lamb Lash, the author of Not in His Image, will speak on the Gnostics. That will be December 29th. Dr. Stanislav Groth, the grandfather of LSD and psychedelic studies, will be speaking on his research January 5th. January 12th, we have Dr. Roland Griffiths, the John Hopkins professor who has just completed the psilocybin studies on religious experience. And Griffiths will also be discussing his newest study on psilocybin and cancer research, mirroring somewhat that of Dr. Grobe, who we interviewed in podcast 5. once again, I do have a few copies left of the Holy Mushroom, the numbered and signed copies. There are 35, I believe, left. If you would like to order a copy of that, please go to gnosticmedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com. And if you would like to contact me directly, you can email me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome aboard, John, and thanks for coming on my show.
Well, Jan, I really appreciate the opportunity that you provide for. It's really a unique venue that you have here, where we can really get into the details and some of these interesting questions.
Well, and that's kind of the whole point is to allow everybody to have the stage and allow them enough time to get their points and their theories across. And in my interview with John Hupps a few weeks ago, podcast number 4, we did kind of separate your work out from a lot of the other sort of New Agers in the 2012 movement. And, John Hupps had called you out and asked you to publish some of your findings in the academic journals and things like that. And he thinks that you do have some very interesting and possibly valid points that definitely need further investigation. And so at the same time, he also attacks other points of your work. So we want to give you the stage on those points and allow you to voice where you think Professor Hupps is wrong in his accounts of your work. And I'd also like for you to address where you think he's right and what areas of I think it's important that you discuss what areas of your book, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, you feel are still valid, and maybe some of the ones that you also think might not be valid anymore. So, the idea is really just to have an open platform where the academics, as well as some of what I feel are the leading amateur scholars out there, so that they can sort of come together and bring this information to the public and let the public hear the two sides and understand the debate from both sides, because The general public, I find, has a real distrust of science and things like that. And your work goes into entheogens and things like that. And one of the most interesting things that a lot of people don't understand is that it's really the academics who have laid all of the foreground research into entheogens and all and many of these different aspects. And then some of the greatest discoveries ever made out there have been made by amateurs. So we can never exclude it one from the other. Academia would be lost without amateur scholars, and amateur, the public would be lost without the academics and the scientists. So anyway, with that said, I'll pass things over to you and let you take it from here.
And I'd like to say that I really appreciate John Hupp's engaging the discussion on 2012. I really respect him sort of sticking his neck out. I guess that's the way I sort of see it because 2012 is kind of a difficult topic to get engaged in. It's murky waters. And I think the tendency has been for many, many years for scholars to sort of steer clear of it because it was just so difficult to really dive into that topic. For many years, the 2012 discussion has been co-opted and sort of led by not just independent researchers like myself, but exploiters and people that were sort of using 2012 as a marketing gimmick and not really doing their homework or doing their research into it. There's just so many assumptions built into the 2012 discussion. My assumption and my approach has always been to try to understand 2012 from the vantage point of the people who created the long count calendar. And of course, before one even approaches it in that way, one has to sort of entertain the possibility that there was some kind of intention behind it, or at least that's the sort of working hypothesis. And so my work has proceeded, I believe, rationally. I've engaged in a rational investigation. I've looked very carefully at the site called IZAPA, which Michael Coe, the great scholar Michael Coe, that Dr. Hupp's quoted from on a couple of different points. Michael Coe said that IZAPA was involved in the formulation of the long count calendar. That was a clue for me back in the early 90s when I sort of launched off on this. I think that one can discern two extreme positions in the 2012 discussion. One would be scholars, and the other would be the far end of New Age speculators. And
Could you go
often it's
into,
kind of difficult.
I was just going to ask you, could you go into some of what some of the books and some of the researchers out there that you think are speculative or New Agers that are just out there to profit on the whole thing?
Well, I've spent a great amount of time critiquing the books that have come out on 2012, beginning with The Mayan Prophecies, which was written by Cotterell, Maurice Cotterell, and Adrian Gilbert, came out in 95. It was really the second book that was published that dealt exclusively with the long count calendar and its cycle ending in 2012. The first one was Frank Waters' book, Mexico Mystique, that came out in 1975. And that book was problematic mainly because it drew from the erroneous calculation reported for the cycle ending that appeared in Michael Coe's book that Dr. Hupp's quoted from the Maya. The book called The Maya came out in 66, and there was just Michael Coe was ascribing to the correct correlation, but there's a problem that often happens in converting the dates. Zero, the year zero, does not get counted. And so one has to, instead of doing direct math on bringing the calendar forward into, you know, our modern era, one has to, you know, recognize that the year zero is not counted. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a date that's 1 year behind. So the co-date was reported for 2011, and that was what Frank Waters picked up on. So he, in his book Mexico Mystique, devised astrological charts to try to determine if the precise date of the cycle ending date had anything interesting going on in terms of astronomy, and that if any kind of astrological uniqueness could be ascribed to it. The problem, of course, was that he was using the wrong date, so that was problematic. Now,
didn't
the book by, yeah?
I was just going to ask, didn't Coe later come out and change the date in later editions that he had in the earlier?
Yes, that is true. But that was after Waters was writing. But yeah, it is true that in later editions he, you know, corrected it to December 23rd of 2012, which is a two-day discrepancy with the actual end date, for the reason that he was simply following the dates that were reported by Linda Sheely. And this gets into a whole other issue that, you know, I think even Dr. Hupps mentioned this continuing debate between December 23rd and December 21st. One can look into the details of that debate and find very clearly that the December 23rd information derives from a scholar named Floyd Lounsbury, who was proposing this two-day shift. But his theory is circular. One can read his paper in The Sky in Mayan Literature and note that the graphs and the tables that he's making engage in a kind of circular logic. And in addition, there's other scholars that point out that his argument can't really support a two-day shift. His argument hinged upon the date on which Venus rises as morning star. However, Venus actually varies in its morning star risings between 580 days and 588 days. So there's an inherent 8-day variation in the cycle of Venus, sometimes from cycle to cycle even. So the so-called evidence that he was citing couldn't possibly support a 2-day variation off of the generally accepted December 21st end date. And there's a couple of other reasons that basically show that the Lounsbury position is fallacious. But, you know, what happens...
Just to ask you real quickly, did Carl Coleman base his 2011 date on Michael Coe's original error in the earlier editions?
No, he did not. Calaman's end date is October 29th of 2011, whereas Coe's calculation resulted in December 24th of 2011. And Calaman's position is based on a fairly sophomoric misinterpretation of how the calendar works. Let me go back to how the end date is recorded in the classic period inscriptions. There are several, probably close to a dozen, monuments or dates that are recording the so-called creation date, and it's dated the end of the 13th baktun. And the key is that the corresponding date in the 260-day calendar is always for a how. So you have this static correlation between the end of the 13th baktun correlated with the date for a how. And that's just the fact of the matter. Now, with Calaman's position, he just kind of rejected that as being having any kind of meaning and proposed that the 13 Bakhtun cycle should, by way of this logic that he applied to it, correspond to the day 1 Emish. Emish is the day sign that's usually listed first in the lists of the 20-day signs, and so it has a sort of apparent priority. However, that has nothing to do with the actual way that the calendar works in terms of the year bearers and how it sequences forward and combines with tune beginnings and katun beginnings in the long count. So he sort of based his own invented end date on this misinterpretation of how the calendar works. So, you know, so you have, you know, the Kalman position and Frank Waters' attempt to calculate an astrology chart for the end date, and you had Cotterell and Gilbert's book was an interesting occurrence in the 2012 discussion. It was generally the first book that attempted to treat it seriously. However, the book was so riddled with errors. I interviewed Gilbert back in 1995 when it came out. The book is primarily an expose on the research of Maurice Cotterell, and his theory involved solar sunspot maximum cycles. And there were several internal errors inside of the book, and one can go to my website to read the review essay that I wrote on that, and it's just inherently problematic. Generally, the cycles that he was pointing out ranged from somewhere around 3,300 years to 3,700 years, and he was pinpointing one to have maximized in the year 627 AD. And then elsewhere in the book, they're saying that the next one happens in 2012. Well, anybody can subtract 627 from 2012 and find that that's nowhere close to 3,300 years or 3,700 years. So there was inherent some very difficult problems in that book. So generally, all of you know, I'm in complete agreement with Dr. Hupps around the problems that are out there in the New Age realm of literature that's happening around the 2012 discussion. There are certain key ideas that I've... Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, before you move away from that, I was going to ask if you would care to comment on, stuff like Ian Lundgold's work or any of the others out there. What about, Jose Arguello's as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, we could spend a lot of time on that.
Not too much, but I would like you to comment on it, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh yeah, for the record, it's good. I'm very, very familiar with a lot of the things that have happened with these different writers and what their ideas are and where the mistaken assumptions lie. Ian Lundgold, for example, picked up on Kalman's work, and they sort of traveled together to Mexico, I think around the year 1999, or I think it was the summer of the year 2000, actually. And they were traveling around Mexico, and Ian Lundgold had a placemat for restaurants that he had devised, a method for calculating your birthday in the 260-day calendar. Ian had, in fact, approached me with this methodology that he developed in 1997 or 98, and we talked on the phone a few times about this, and he sent me some samples of his placemat. It seems in subsequent discussions with Eric Gonzalez, who hosted Ian at his home in 1996, that they both had copies of my book, Dzogchen, which had come out in 1994. And in that book, which is now out of print, I provided many, many pages of charts as well as a method for calculating your Dzogchen birthday. I was only interested in collapsing the methodology for doing that down to one page, you know, something that could fit on one page of a book. And you have to look up the month position on the chart, and then you add a certain number, and you can basically figure out if your birthday is falls on the day 4 house or 6 jaguar, that kind of thing. Now, it seems like Lungold had taken my charts and simplified them even more. So he was able to basically truncate the mathematical process by eliminating, you know, factors of 100 or something like that. My method just took the numbers out of the Julian Day almanacs, and I didn't really attempt to sort of break them down. But the point is that he had sort of adapted my charts to create this placemat that then he was trying to market and sell, and it seemed to him like a good idea. And in his process of traveling with Kalaman, I think he ended up sort of adopting the general idea that Kalaman is known for, which has to do with this time speeding up idea based on a factor of 20. And the long count works by way of factors of 20. So this seemed to make sense to Kalaman in terms of a time speeding up model. What people have sort of forgotten is that it was Terence McKenna that originally proposed a time speeding up idea. And, of course, Terence has had his own theory attached to 2012 that is a quite unique and interesting sort of visionary proposition about the nature of time and how it points to 2012. But, yeah, at any rate, I see Lungold as sort of being a... along with Kalaman on some of those perspectives on the calendar.
I was just going to say I met Ian Lungold back in 2004-2005 out in LA, and I saw his presentation, which I, to be honest, wasn't all that impressed with. And after his show, I asked him about Terence McKenna's work and if he was familiar with it, and ironically he said that he wasn't.
Well, that's could very well be the case.
Oh, you know, and I'm sure it is, you know, but he was in fact, he even scoffed at the idea. But it's just ironic because McKenna was the origin of his theory and he didn't even himself know it, and I called him out on it at his lecture.
Well, it would have come to him probably through Kalaman, at least the general idea of the time speeding up idea, which one can call into question too. You know, all of these things need to be sort of critically evaluated. But yeah, it's no doubt that he had adapted some of the ideas that were coming through to him from Kalaman, and Ian was an interesting guy. I had some good conversations with him early on. We sort of went different ways pretty early on because he wanted me to go to Mexico with him and stuff. He was a jeweler, very talented artist and jeweler, and he made some nice little replicas of some of the Maya designs. Now, as for Arguelles, this is a kind of a big discussion. I've been very interested in this. I guess it would be important for me to trace how I came into the 2012 awareness myself, and it sort of might seem a little bit unusual, but I trace my very first inkling of something involving this end of Indian calendar down in Mexico back to when I was 12 years old. And I tell the story in one of my articles about this, and I don't really indulge in, you know, telling my story or something like that, but for this particular article it seemed relevant. And basically, I was hanging out with a friend of mine, and we had just been to the 4th of July Bicentennial Parade, and big time was on our minds, and my friend Joe mentioned that his dad was reading a book about a calendar that the Indians down in Mexico had, and it was supposed to end in the near future, in the year 2011, as a matter of fact. And later on that day, I was over at Joe's house, and I asked his dad about this book, and he showed it to me. And I, you know, years later, when I really started getting into the research, I had a deep sense of recognition when I encountered Frank Waters' book, Mexico Mystique. Had a big blue dust jacket, and I definitely remembered that. It was almost like an idea got planted in my mind at the age of 12, and it was also sort of an entree into this more philosophical attitude towards things, you know, big time, cycles of time, this kind of thing. And also that summer, through another channel, I was given the book Quetzalcoatl, Lord of the Dawn by Tony Shearer. And Tony Shearer was a writer who was working with the 260-day calendar in a kind of a poetic way. And I really think of Tony Shearer as being the grandfather of the 2012 discussion, at least in its popular manifestations. When Tony Shearer first wrote about the Mesoamerican calendar back in 1970, and then again later in a book that came out in 75, it was not something that was a topic of, you know, popular discussion. Now, the important point here is that Tony was not talking about the long count calendar in the 2012 date. He was looking at the calendar round system that was followed in central Mexico among the Aztecs. And when he worked with that system, he proposed that there was a reconstruction that could be made that pointed to the year 1987. So this later became used or appropriated by Jose Arguelles, and it turned into the harmonic convergence event. So not a lot of people remember or realize that Jose Arguelles is not really the originator of the harmonic convergence date. He certainly popularized it in his 1987 book, The Mayan Factor, and it was certainly a kind of a cultural phenomenon at that time. But you know, when I was doing my research and starting to travel to Central America in the mid-80s, and practically every winter I was able to cut loose and save up a couple hundred bucks and take the bus to the border and get down to the temple sites, I was encountering Arguelles' work, and it always struck me as being problematic, certainly having a kind of a compelling vibe around it as being an expression of a Carlos Castaneda kind of wizard system or something like that. And that can be sort of fun, you know. But in terms of it having any integrity, in my brief look at it, it became very clear very quickly that it was problematic because the calendar system that he was proposing that we all follow was in fact not the Maya calendar, but a system of his own creation on a very, very important detail, and that detail being what day is it today in the 260-day calendar. So that was incredibly problematic, and in the early 90s when I was pointing this out to people, I basically was turned into the messenger delivering bad news who should be dispensed with. This was not, of course, among scholars. This had nothing to do with really academia. It was really more applicable to the realm of people that were blindly following this system that Arguelles had created that became better known as the dream spell system, which was sort of published and put out there as a kit or a game in early 1992. And again, the main problem with this system is that it was not in synchronization with the correct correlation that survives in the highlands of Guatemala. And the fact that the 260-day calendar survives in the highlands is a fact that ethnographers like Barbara Tedlock have proven, and it's a well-known fact. But apparently it was not known to Arguelles when he was doing his visionary work with the Mesoamerican calendar back in the 70s and 80s.
Fascinating. So would you care to comment on Daniel Pinchback's book, 2012?
I was somewhat surprised when I was informed that that book was coming out. I think I guess I had heard rumor that it was coming out. Daniel himself, I guess, emailed me at some point and said, "The book's coming out. Do you want a pre-press copy?" That kind of thing. So I did get a pre-press copy right before it was officially released. And I had been in contact with Daniel a few years prior to that, because I think it must have been around the year 2001. And he contacted me, and of course I have had a couple of books out by then, the My Cosmogenesis book. And he was sort of trying to engage a discussion around José Arguelles. And so I actually sent him a digital copy of my book Vulcan, which came out in 94, which went into partly was devoted to clarifying the errors of Dreamspell and the system that José had put on the table back then. And I didn't hear back from him at that point. So I think he said that he was working on an article for Rolling Stones magazine, but I don't believe one ever came out. I think his interest in the Maya calendar stuff probably developed into him securing a contract for his book with Tatra Penguin, which then, of course, did come out in 2006. I think I was a bit disappointed with the treatment of the 2012 material. It seemed to me a little bit unusual that in a book with 2012 in the title, the subject was not even broached until something like page 116 or something. And he did certainly sketch my work. I was grateful that he was more or less accurate in his summation of my work. Often, authors will summarize my work and just get it completely wrong in the process of paraphrasing it, which, of course, then creates problems for me later on because I have to do damage control when people contact me and say, "This person said you said this." And, you know, it can be really maddening in that sense. But he did seem in that book to generally favor the Calamon position. And that was a bit baffling because if one applies an understanding of how the calendar works to Calamon's position, it's very clear to see that Calamon is not engaging in any kind of accurate reconstruction of the ancient calendar. He's sort of engaging in this other thing, which we should probably talk about a little bit. It's very much what Arguelles did, and even to a certain extent of what McKenna was doing. It's visionary myth-making. It's visionary model-making. It's this idea that we're sort of free to cobble together our own sort of new trademarkable cosmology or system. You know, there definitely was an evangelical angle on Calamon's proselytizing of his system. With Calamon's work, it required, though, that the official and widely accepted end date, December 21st of 2012, had to be knocked off its peg. And Calamon did, with a fair amount of intellectual dishonesty, engage in trying to do that on several fronts and it's periodically over the years. And so I think that's pretty clear, and it says a lot about where Calamon was coming from. One could say that, yes, it's a cool idea that time is speeding up, and you can make a model where you have these, you know, expansions of time cycles based on 20. However, another problem in his model is that expansion by 20, a base 20, then has to ignore that there is, in fact, a 13 Bakhtun cycle, that the world age period that one finds on the creation monuments is not a 20 Bakhtun cycle, but a 13 Bakhtun cycle. So it sort of throws a monkey wrench into the theoretical basis of Kalman's ideas. So it was a bit sort of disturbing to see that Pinchbeck had sort of, you know, found the Kalman position to be compelling in any way.
So it's basically create the idea and then try and force the scholarship to fit the idea instead of the other way around.
Well, yeah. I think that it is important, and I should also say that as I listened to the interview with Dr. Hupps, that I was in great agreement with him on many of his critiques of the problems of people writing about Maya culture or 2012 specifically, and it being very clear that they have not done their homework. The one problem that I find a lot of times is that I'm often put in that category. It is true that my books were published with trade publishers. I did not have much of an alternative in my process in terms of getting my research out there and published and onto shelves and made available for the public to read and assess. But often what I find is that my work does, perhaps unintentionally, and maybe it's not even the intention of the people that are saying it, but nevertheless it does then seem like my work is, like Jenkins is one of those guys, you know, that's writing mass market trade paperback books on the Maya tradition. But I think a real big distinction needs to be made, and I think it sort of was made in your interview. One can look at the bibliography for my book Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 and find primarily academic sources, and these are this is the source material that I studied and I read, and in fact in the published version of the book it was cut by 40%. I had to cut it because of the sheer length of the bibliographic sources that went into my work. So if you compare that bibliography to, say, Kalman's or Arguelles, you know, there's no comparison at all. So it's also strange then that I sort of get sort of combined with Arguelles and Kalman as being, you know, one of those guys that's doing something with 2012, which I guess is sort of true, but I would hope that my work can be distinguished because it's actually making an attempt to reconstruct the ancient Maya calendar or cosmology that's connected with 2012.
What specific points in Hupp's interview would you like to address?
Oh, well, there were a few things. Again, I'd like to just emphasize that I really appreciate John, you know, engaging these topics. Generally speaking, in my experience with scholars over the last 15, 20 years, it has to be said that for many years, 2012 has been disregarded as a subject not worth commenting on. One of the compelling facts of the end date is that it falls on an accurate December solstice. And that was my entree into trying to engage scholars on this topic. Basically, the rational critical thinking that goes into the question posed is, well, the end date falls on a December solstice. Doesn't this mean that possibly there is some kind of intentionality behind that placement? Well, virtually all of the scholars that I talked with for about 10 years said it must be a coincidence. And I found this to be incredibly close-minded because my research proceeded on the assumption that it wasn't a coincidence, and it generated a course of investigation that has led to some pretty interesting results. Now, in more recent years, scholars have started to comment on 2012, and it should be said that John Hupps and one or two other scholars have indeed responded to my work and have offered their critiques of it. So there's been an underlying sort of thread of response to my work. But I guess what I'd say is that in recent years, scholars have been turning their attention to 2012 and saying things about it. However, many of the comments that are being offered about 2012 by scholars are directed towards the far end of the New Age spectrum. So there's a tendency of scholars to comment on sort of the sociological phenomenon of millenarian hysteria, you know, that sort of Y2K phenomenon where
the apocalyptic,
it's so predictable that human beings will get all hysterical at the end of a cycle, and so it's sort of being a sort of a sociologist instead of doing what scholars should do, which is investigating the thing in itself, examining 2012, which is after all a true artifact of the calendar system, and generating questions and investigating those questions and determining if there is indeed any kind of intentionality behind that date by the creators of the long count calendar, and what their beliefs and ideas might have been around this particular date. So that's a general entree into how I've been relating to scholars on these questions for quite a while now. I've also been very active on the online email lists. The ASPLAN email list is one of them. I've been engaged in that since, I think 96. I was more active on it in 99. And then in the recent couple of years, I probably shed 200 pages of digital ink on that, going back and forth on debates. And, you know, there is this question of offering up a paper for peer review, you know, which is an interesting possibility, I suppose, at this point. I feel like many of the points that I would bring to bear on a 25-page article were points that I actually put on the table 10 years ago in my book, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. But I do understand the value of sort of repackaging it and offering it once again for academic scrutiny. But at the same time, I think that these email lists can be a nice sort of battleground for these ideas. It really reveals in a much more immediate and real way the kinds of assumptions that scholars have and where the problems really lie. For example, one of the things that Hupps brought up, we might even have to go into a little bit of explanation on what my theory is about, but one of the points he brought up has to do with using the term galactic center. And I do use the term galactic center. I've always been very clear in my writings to make it clear that, you know, by using the term galactic center, when you're talking about the sky and astronomy and maybe defining things in a scientifically rigorous way, you want to use the accurate terminology that modern astronomers would recognize. But that doesn't imply that the ancient Maya had the exact same kind of identical conceptual understanding that modern science has. It's kind of a fallacious assumption. And this has happened several times. In fact, another scholar, Anthony Avini, has assumed this to be true when I defined the galactic alignment as the alignment of the December solstice sun with the galactic equator. He assumes then that I'm asserting that the Maya themselves had a concept that was equivalent to the modern scientific astronomical concept of the galactic equator. But if he was actually to read my books, he would understand that there's a distinction to be made between that and what the ancient Maya stargazers or sky watchers were actually looking at. So that's kind of a problematic thing. I do understand that if you use the term galaxy, which I use quite liberally, in my mind, the galaxy is equivalent to the Milky Way, and we can all see the Milky Way out there if we look up at the sky. We can go out there and see the galaxy. But there's sort of a reaction that maybe some people have to the use of this terminology, because as Dr. Hupps points out, it sort of smacks of some kind of Eric von Däniken spaceship stuff. I never really understood that problem. We're just using words for what they are. But the critique that he offered actually revolved more around the idea that the Maya would have understood that part of the Milky Way as being the center, the galactic center. And I have a very important response to that, that in fact I offered to the Aztlan email list back in 1999. I think that might have been a period of time when Dr. Hupps was actually a moderator on the Aztlan list. And one can go to the archives of the Aztlan list for May or June of 1999 and find this very brief, concise, to the point, factual, open letter to scholars and astronomers. And basically, in a nutshell, the question is, did the Maya think of the galactic center as a center? And the answer is yes. If you look at Maya concepts, they recognize that there's a cross in the sky. It's the place where the Milky Way crosses over the ecliptic. And this cross is located between the constellations of Sagittarius and Scorpio. And it basically targets that part of the Milky Way where the nuclear bulge of the galactic center is located. Now, we have to be very clear to point out that the galactic center is often thought of by astronomers as an abstract point in the sky, which, in fact, in reality, it is not a point in the sky. To naked eye sky watchers, the center of the Milky Way is that part of the Milky Way that's wider and contains more bright stars. It gives the impression of a bulging area of the Milky Way. And in fact, it's referred to as by astronomers as the nuclear bulge. And it just so happens that this cosmic cross of the Milky Way and the ecliptic, which the Maya called the crossroads or the sacred tree, targets this nuclear bulge of the galactic center. Now, it's important to also recognize, as Carl Taub and other Maya scholars themselves have pointed out, that the Maya symbol of the cross was often used on thrones and almost universally signifies the concept of cosmic center. I think that pretty much sums up my position on how and why the Maya thought of the region of the Milky Way that does contain the galactic center as a cosmic center. The other piece of evidence in this, which simply adds more fuel to the fire, is the fact that along the Milky Way, in the region, you know, in this section of the nuclear bulge, is a feature called the dark rift, and this is caused by interstellar dust. It's an important feature in the Maya creation myth. It's called the Xibalba Bay, which translates variously as the road of fear or the road to the underworld. It's part of a whole complex of concepts that share ideation with the mouth of a cave, the mouth of a snake, the mouth of an alligator, even by way of linguistics and, again, conceptual association. This dark rift in the Milky Way is equated or compared to a birthplace. The mouth of a cave is called Ch'en in the Tzoltzil language, and this is also the word for the vagina of a woman. So there's linguistic and iconographic arguments that can be put on the table to show that the dark rift in the Milky Way was thought of as a birthplace. And knowing then, of course, that the dark rift is co-spatial with the crossroads and the nuclear bulge of the galactic center, we can then also see how and why the Maya thought of the galactic center region as not only a center, but also as a birthplace. So these, you know, this certainly points out something very important. The ancient Maya were thinking about that part of the Milky Way that contains the galactic center accurately. And we have evidence for it. So this is sort of how my research proceeds. It proceeds based upon synthesizing known material from academic scholarship, putting it on the table, and saying something about it that nobody else apparently was willing to say.
Have you read Prudence Rice's recent book, Maya Calendar Origins?
Oh yeah, I'm reading it right now.
And do you have anything to comment about that book?
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And she goes into the site of Izapa in a very important way. One of her ideas is that the site of Izapa was primarily a ceremonial site and that there was astronomy going on at the site, but it was also an initiation center. And I agree with this. That's what I also wrote about in a couple of chapters in my book in Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. And in Prudence Rice's book, she also starts out by framing her approach to the material in a way that I think is really important, because some scholars tend to have a very tight hold on what can be allowed and what cannot be allowed into the discussion. Often they frame this disallowance by saying that that other stuff is not scientifically rigorous, but that's kind of a false perspective. For example, carved monuments that contain pictographs, they often are very sophisticated in how they portray astronomical alignments and how they can be read in terms of an expression of ideology and rituals and ceremonies and teachings even. And then, of course, because they're oriented to certain astronomical horizons, one can understand the integrated nature of Mayan thought when it comes to how astronomy and mythology go together. And oftentimes, pictographic monuments are simply not allowed as being documents. They're not considered to be good statements. They're not sort of included in the category of evidence that can tell us anything about what, say, the Izapans believed. There's sort of a bias towards language that is written either in hieroglyphs or alphabetic script. You know, the preference would be that some lost book is found that can be read and deciphered that is saying something very specific about what the ancient Maya believed. But as usually is the case, in the process of reconstructing ancient beliefs and the ancient cosmology that's connected with the 2012 date and the Long Count calendar, one needs to have a more expanded allowance of what's included into the discussion. Now, this isn't making a plea to, you know, give license for speculating. You know, that's often then the critique. You know, we can't allow speculation. And I think there's a real bias around even including myth or mythology as being a viable source of data. Often, and I sort of sense this a bit in how the term is used by scholars, quite often myth is equated with a lie. And I think this is a really entrenched sort of bias in a kind of approach to ancient traditions, including the Maya, that myth or mythology is unreliable, and it's basically subject to ambiguous interpretations. And I think Prudence Rice and there's other scholars that have a more expanded approach towards how much attention and credence we should give to these sources of evidence that oftentimes scholars of a kind of a more hardcore nature would simply not allow into the discussion.
Well, I'd like to use this as an opportunity to segue into Izapa. If you could talk a little bit about your research and how Izapa is important to that.
Right. Well, yeah, I appreciate that. In my research, I identified Izapa as a place of interest in terms of when and where the long count calendar was formulated. And there's good reasons for this. Izapa was experiencing its heyday in the 3rd, 2nd, and 1st centuries BC, and that is indeed towards the end of that period in the 1st century BC, that is when we find the first dated monuments in the long count. There's one from 37 BC, and there's another at the site of Takalik Abba, which was kind of a sister city to Izapa. It should be said that no long count dates were found at the site of Izapa, but there's a Isthmian region that included the late Olmec period and the transitional Izapan civilization that Michael Coe writes about, transitioning into the early burgeoning Maya civilization that is the classic Maya period, usually beginning in 200 AD. So Izapa was a critical transitional cultural phase that was clearly involved in giving rise to this long count calendar tradition. And I think of Izapa as being a critical place to look at because astronomy was very important at the site. And I'll backpedal a little bit here and just lay out what my proposition and theory is for 2012 in terms of what the Maya were trying to point at, why the Maya thought that December 21st of 2012 would be significant. It has to do with the astronomical alignment that I refer to as the galactic alignment. And this is a rare alignment in the cycle of the precession of the equinoxes, and it's an astronomical fact. It can be defined by using the dark rift in the Milky Way, which, as we know, was a significant feature in the Maya creation mythology. That basically what's happening is that the December solstice sun has converged over many hundreds of years with this spot on the Milky Way where the dark rift is located. So it's really an alignment between the dark rift in the Milky Way and the December solstice sun. So of course the end date falls on a December solstice, so that's significant. And my entire argument for showing how this indeed is the target that the ancient Maya were intending in placing their calendar, the end of their 13 Bakhtun cycle, on December 21st of 2012, my whole argument does not proceed by assuming that they had a huge degree of accuracy in their ability to calculate this precessional process. Certainly, they were capable of a good amount of accuracy in order to get it pretty much on target. But in fact, my argument proceeds by showing that the astronomical features involved in the alignment are front and center in very important Maya institutions, such as the Maya creation myth, as I've sketched a little bit, and the ball game. The sacred ball game of the Maya is very important key to Izapa, and also to showing how the galactic alignment was symbolized or mythologized by the ancient Maya. The ball court is basically a symbol of the Milky Way, and the ball game always has symbolized the rebirth of the sun. The ball game is actually very integral to the Maya creation myth. It's played, and the Hero Twins play the ball game, and they defeat the Lords of Darkness, or the Lords of the Underworld, in the ball game. And then they are able to facilitate the resurrection or rebirth of their father, Wunhunapu. So again, that's the solar deity being reborn, the rebirth of the sun at the end of the game. Now, at Azapa, there is a ball court. It's in the Group F area on the north side of the site. And I really spent a lot of time examining the site of Azapa. I've been there many times myself. But there's also three volumes that were published by Brigham Young University. Archaeologists had examined the site in the 1960s and uncovered and reset many of the monuments. The monuments at Azapa were found in situ as they were left some 1,800 years ago or so. In other words, the site had not been disturbed, which Prudence Rice, for example, believes indicates that it was an honored and respected site through the centuries, possibly the location of ongoing pilgrimages and initiation rituals through the centuries, and that's why the site wasn't really destroyed, as we have seen with other sites that were just sort of built over and so on. Now, the ball court at Azapa is really critical to my theory because it lines up with the position of the December solstice sunrise. This is something that was not recognized by the Brigham Young scholars, even though their maps and their survey alignments basically indicate this to be so. In other words, one can read the maps that they provided very carefully and notice that the ball court is pointing to that horizon azimuth that the sun rises at. It's sort of like you have to put two and two together, and that's what I did back in the early 90s when I was doing my research. However, and unfortunately for me, because the fact of that was never enunciated by the archaeologists from Brigham Young University, the fact that I say it and have observed it at the site myself and have measured it with an astronomical instrument that I myself built and brought to the site basically doesn't mean a lot. In other words, what I say is not trusted in or believed in. I've got several pages on my website that show that the ball court at Azapa lines up with the December solstice sunrise. Now, the reason this is important because the astronomy of this alignment then provides a key to interpreting certain monuments that are preserved in the ball court, namely a throne on the west end of the ball court. The throne on the west end of the ball court basically faces down the lengthwise axis of the ball court to the rise position of the December solstice sun. Now, it's over that horizon, the December solstice sunrise horizon, that I believe ancient sky watchers would have been able to track this processional process and this future convergence of the December solstice sun with the dark rift in the Milky Way. Now, there's another sort of fallacious critique that Dr. Hoops put on the table in your interview with him, that it basically is this idea that in 2012, the sun will be right in that position with the dark rift in the Milky Way. Therefore, you can't see anything. This is what's known as it's just a fallacious critique. I mean, it's kind of like, it's kind of like you saying that you're a writer and me saying, oh, Jan, I don't believe you're a writer. And then you saying, why not? And me saying, because you wear shoes. It's a fallacious critique. Because the important point is what the ancient sky watchers were looking at. It doesn't matter that in our current era, when the alignment happens, that nobody can actually look at it. What was important was that 2,000 years ago, a sky watcher could have observed over the horizon of the December solstice sunrise, they could have observed the dark rift rising. The dark rift in the Milky Way would be rising in the pre-dawn skies before the sun rises. And then as the sun rose, the sky would lighten, and then, of course, the Milky Way would fade back into the background. But what I propose is that they would have been able to notice, I mean, if it was done, let's put it this way, if precession was calculated and if there was a projection forward to 2012, the way it would have been done is that they would have noticed in this way that there was a convergence happening between the dark rift in the Milky Way and the December solstice sun, that they were drawing closer and closer together. So all of this, in terms of a technical achievement, hinges on whether or not they could have calculated the precession, the precessional movement, the rate of precession with any degree of accuracy.
And what,
now, on this front, we have some...
I was just going to ask, what evidence do we have today from scholars that they were doing that? Is there any solid evidence? Are they still speculating? What's the... What's the evidence there?
Well, in fact, and of course this is often not cited by critics, but in fact we do have a certain amount of contextual evidence that the ancient Mesoamericans were aware that the skies were shifting. We have evidence from the site of La Venta, which actually goes back to 1200 BC, that comes from the work of archaeologist Marion Popino Hatch. And we also have evidence from the site of Takalik Aba, which is contemporaneous or even a slightly before Izapa's heyday. We have evidence from that site by way of some stone alignments to a star in the northern sky, and then the stone alignments being shifted to account for that star's shifting position with precession. And more recently, we have evidence from two scholars, Barbara McLeod, who's a veteran epigrapher, who's contributed great insights to the decipherment of the Maya script. She's isolated a formula in the hieroglyphic corpus that she calls the 311 peak formula. It's an interval of 3 baktuns, 11 khatuns, three khatuns, 11 tunes, that is very critical for understanding this large interval that they used, that the ancient Maya used. And what she noticed is that this very large interval is a very precise calculation of precessional intervals. Now, there's another scholar named Michael Groff, and this is very exciting, actually, because this is recent stuff. Another scholar, Michael Groff, who just got his PhD thesis, University of California, last year, and he examined the serpent sequence in the Dresden Codex, which is one of the few surviving Mayan books, and he too has found a calculational mechanism that the classic period Maya were clearly using that indicates a very, very high degree of precision in their ability to calculate precession. So, you know, again, this is very, very, very important contributing information for my thesis, and I do see it that way. But again, my particular approach has been to show how the iconography on the carved monuments at the site of Izapa and the ball cord alignment are critical to understanding how they... basically, I guess in a nutshell, you can say, it's sort of hard to do this in an interview without pictures, but there are several carved monuments from Izapa that are basically portraying the December solstice sun in the dark rift in the Milky Way. Now, this can be criticized as being a fanciful, speculative interpretation, but one has to understand the several lines of iconographic, linguistic, hieroglyphic archaeoastronomical evidence that feeds into making this statement. So it's quite frustrating for me to lay this all out in my book with the citations to the original scholarship and then sort of be accused of just making vague speculations or the idea that, you know, mythology or iconography even, the interpretation of it cannot be trusted because it's subject to such ambiguous interpretation, which in a certain sense is true, but my work proceeds by looking at the astronomical alignments of the monuments and interpreting the content of the monuments based on their orientations. So, for example, that throne that I mentioned that's on the west end of the Azapan ball court, that throne has a solar head. It's a solar deity that's being born from between two legs that are carved on the front end of the throne. Clearly, this is an image of solar birth. Now, remember, the ball game itself is about the rebirth of the sun.
Well,
now the fact that...
To interject real quick, very interestingly, the sun is born under the constellation of Virgo on the solstice as well. And you know, the souls the constellation Virgo being the celestial virgin, and on December 25th the sun is born between Virgo's legs. Go ahead.
Well, at Azapa, if I was to say that the throne depicts the December solstice sun, that could be criticized as being a kind of a speculative interpretation. But my argument that supports that interpretation is the fact that the throne is oriented down the lengthwise axis of the ball court to the rise position of the December solstice sunrise. So, again, you know, this is just sort of a tortured way of trying to get across to my critics, as well as your listeners, that my work basically stands in its own category. And yes, it is frustrating to be lumped together into the category of people who write trade paperbacks or something and versus scholars that get material published in academic journals. On that front, I'd sort of like to point something out that's really interesting in terms of how rigorous a peer-reviewed journal may be, and that has to do with the second edition of the book Sky Watchers of Ancient Mexico by Anthony Avini, who's a great scholar, and he's made many contributions. And he's an archaeoastronomer. And in this second edition of this great book that he wrote, he reports that the end date is December 8th of 2012. And I noticed this, and I was like, huh, geez, you know, why did he do that? And then I got an email from somebody who wanted to know why he would report that. And so I had to sort of get out the charts and the tables and figure out what must have gone wrong there. Well, one of the problems is that he was reporting it in the Julian calendar, not the Gregorian calendar, and also that he appeared to be using a 365.25-day estimate for calculating that remainder of the 2012 year. So I basically deciphered the error, and I posted it on my website. And I thought, well, this is really problematic because, you know, I'm sure that Avini will be quoted as an authoritative person on when the end date occurs. And here in his book, it appears to be December 8th of 2012. Well, you know, you can go to any number of journals that provided reviews of his book. None of them point out this error.
Did you publish
so what's the
in
point
the...
of peer...
Well, have you, since you found
no,
that...
No, I didn't.
Well, why not?
I have no entree into getting published in, like, American Anthropologist or anything like that.
Well, let's see if we can try and make that happen. Because I think that
Well,
would
in fact,
be.
yeah, I'm open to that possibility.
That seems
In
like
fact,
something that would be. That seems like something that would be great for you to address and to publish in the journals.
well, yeah, I'm happy to give it another shot, and I do appreciate the opportunity. And if I put a lot of late nights into responding to the 50 critics that are going to jump on me, I'm sure that some progress might end up happening. I guess on another front, which might be a little bit easier for me to achieve, considering that I'm not connected to the university and I'm having to do many things in order to pay my bills, and time seems to be of the essence these days. Another idea I had that might be something that I'd really like to that's more pointed in terms of this issue. I did hear that Anthony Iovine is working on a book on 2012. He himself has published many trade paperbacks and sort of popular books on the Maya and time and calendars and stuff like that. So now he's jumping into the ring with his own 2012 book. And what I would like to do is write a review essay. And my hope is that Dr. John Hupps can suggest, let's say, five academic journals that I could submit my review essay of Iovine's book to. Okay? So this is just going on the record right now. And I'm sure John could come up with five, and I will do it, and I will submit them, and we'll see how many say we will publish this.
Well, that sounds like a reasonable request and statement to me. I wanted to, we're approaching an hour and a half here pretty quickly, but I wanted to ask if you could, one of the fascinating points about your research in Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 was, in my opinion, your recreation of the of what you think to be the initiation ritual and and the use of the entheogenic or psychedelic drugs and how that was done and maybe at what part each of the different substances was used and things like that. Could you go into that?
Sure. Well, part of my understanding of the site of Azapa is that it was an initiation center. And as I mentioned, several other scholars, including Prudence Rice, sort of see it that way too. There is evidence at the site that entheogens were used. There is a carved monument called Stela 6 that depicts a Bufo marinus toad that shows little dots on the shoulder with vision scrolls coming out. This is a clear indication that those glands on the shoulder of the Bufo marinus toad were being thought of as a source of vision. And as you pointed out in your interview, the Bufo marinus toad is not only a source of
Bufotenin.
bufetamine. What is that?
Well, bufotenin
Bufotenin.
and 5-methoxy-N,N-dimethyltryptamine,
Yes,
which
which
is
I think is the
probably
more
the most,
critical.
and 5-methoxy-N,N-DMT is probably the most powerful entheogen out there. In my opinion, it's far more powerful than straight N,N-dimethyltryptamine.
Right. Okay, so then my interpretation, and this perhaps goes more to a speculative reconstruction, but my sense is that the site of Azapa was the site of a cosmological shift among the Mesoamerican people. The earlier Olmec were oriented to the northern polar region. We see this at their site of La Venta and so on. And then the Azapans, in my theory, became interested in this other cosmic center, namely the nuclear bulge of the galactic center, and how that was mythologized as a creation place, and when the sun lines up with it, it signifies the end of a world age, and so on. With these understandings or interpretations under my belt, I then would look to the site of Azapa, and this is where it really becomes sort of speculative, but My sense was that it was an initiation site, and there's three main monument groups. Each one of them represents a cosmic center. In the Group A section, you have an orientation to the polar center and the Big Dipper, which moves around the polar region. And in the Group B area, you have vertical stone pillars, which indicate shadows cast by the sun, as well as when the sun casts no shadow, indicating that that group was dedicated to the zenith center, the exact center of the sky overhead. And in the tropical region, when the sun passes through the zenith, no shadows are cast. And then, of course, the Group F ball court at Azapa was oriented to the December solstice position and, according to my theory, the future alignment to the galactic center. So you have these three different cosmic centers integrated at the site of Azapa, and my initiation scenario proposes that prospective daykeepers or shamans were initiated into this larger galactic perspective. This is a cosmological shift similar to how the Copernican Revolution realized that the Earth was no longer the center and that the Sun was the center. In a similar way, as people anywhere on the planet evolve their thinking on cosmological themes, they advance from one to the next. So for the Azapans, the older polar god of the Olmec ancestors was no longer really valid, or it had it was sort of demonized, as a matter of fact. It turned into the Seven Macaw deity in the Popol Vuh, who was seen to be the ruler of a previous world age that had to be put in his place, and the Hero Twins did, in fact, facilitate his demise. So that was sort of like putting the polar center back into its place, and then I think that, you know, it's quite clear that the shamans of Azapa were then initiated into this larger galactic perspective that included time, namely the new discovery of the precession of the equinoxes, and this future projection to a time when the December solstice sun would line up with the dark rift in the Milky Way, and how that was then thought to be a signal for the end of this 13 Bakhtun cycle. And this also then brings up another critique around, in my understanding, and I think that this can be, you know, argued for with good evidence, the creation mythology of the Maya details, it's basically a world age doctrine, and the 13 Bakhtun cycle of the Long Count calendar also is an expression of a world age doctrine. And the connection that I make, which I think is more of a deductive conclusion rather than a speculative one, is that the 13 Bakhtun cycle in the Long Count would be equivalent to a world age, the kind of world age that is expressed in the Maya creation myth. So you have this integration of mythology, calendar, and astronomy happening. So this, I think, is what Azapa signifies in terms of it being an initiation center. On another more poetic level, I think it probably functioned in a similar way that the great site of Eleusis did, where it was an initiation through the use of entheogens into a higher consciousness or an expanded state of consciousness that could then directly perceive insights about the nature of reality.
And I'd like to interject there that John is referring to Professor Carl Ruck and Gordon Wasson and Albert Hoffman's work into Eleusis. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it should be said too that for, I don't know, 1,000 years, the site of Eleusis was the center of initiation rites that did use an entheogen. And all the great minds that we associate with the dawn of Western philosophy, including Plato and Socrates, were initiated into those mysteries.
Recently, there's been a video that's come out called "Is 2012 Totally Debunked?" Would you talk about that video?
Okay. Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. This
Let's
came to my attention.
make
Yes?
this let's wrap it up with the discussion about this video.
All right. Well, I will say right off that I did write a review critique of that, and I will try to post a link to your site on your site to a page that I'll post on that so listeners can check that out. Basically, it's a problematic sort of critique of the galactic alignment material. One of the critiques in there, I don't know how to even, frame it in a tight way. It's just problematic in so many ways. It engages in several assumptions about 2012. One of which just is clear from the title: Can 2012 be debunked? I mean, 2012 is a fact of the Maya calendar. That's like saying you're going to debunk sex or something. Can you debunk sex? It's a fact of biology, So it sort of proceeds on some fallacious assumptions. When it comes to an illustration of my galactic alignment work, it's very, very strange because the filmmaker utilizes diagrams from my books to accurately illustrate the galactic alignment, but then later he's conflating it with this other idea that's not the galactic alignment at all. This other idea, which is a huge, huge misunderstanding of what the galactic alignment is, has to do with the orbit of our solar system around the center of the Milky Way galaxy. This orbital process takes on the order of 240 million years, and there's this idea that our solar system moves up and down and up and down in a kind of a sinusoidal wave pattern up and above and below the galactic midplane. The problem is that we are well above the galactic midplane right now, as my friend Jeff Stray has pointed out, who's another great resource for accurate information and critiques on the various books that are coming out on the Maya calendar in 2012. Jeff Stray's book, Beyond 2012, is a huge resource on these things. But he critiqued it and pointed out to me that idea is fallacious for that reason. And so, I don't know, it's one of those manifestations that we're actually inundated with, and that Dr. Hoop's critiques, rightly so, and I agree with him completely that 95% of the discussion that's happening around 2012 is just extremely problematic based upon poor research. And so we need to approach the material very, very carefully.
Well, and I think that video, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm 99% sure that that video was put out by a guy named Chris White, who I've actually had some interaction with over the last year. And I'm surprised that he referenced anything in your book, because he and I have gone round and round and round about actually reading the scholars that he attacks. And he's admitted to me several times that he's never read any of the books of the people he attacks. And he started this big conspiracy theory about John Allegro and his research earlier this year, just completely twisting and making up history as he goes so that he could create this Illuminatus conspiracy theory around John Allegro and the Rockefellers, which, it's really sad because, Allegro dedicated so much of his time and his books to explaining and detailing the history of what he had to do and everything. And this is revealed very explicitly in the book published in 2005 by his daughter, where she went through and published all of John Allegro's private letters that reveal that these sort of attacks are completely fallacious as well. But unfortunately, people like this, and in general, what I've found is most of the people that attack any work in general, attack it without ever reading it first, and that's a very significant problem. And I think, you know, Chris White's direction is to argue that Christianity is correct no matter what, without critically analyzing his own belief systems, and then attacking everyone else who challenges that as some sort of Illuminatus conspiracy theorist or conspiracy creator, if you know what I mean. So, you know, it's just, you know, I wanted to address that too, because it's rather unfortunate that people like this go around and act as though they're spreading truth when really they're just creating bigger lies and bigger myths, because they're not even in the slightest way familiar with the research itself.
Well, that is a huge problem, and I, for one, am interested in engaging in critical thinking and appraisal of evidence. I find one problem with my own research is that, and I know this from many, many, many interactions with scholars on the various, through the mail, for one thing, back in the 90s, and then by email, and then by jumping into the trenches on these academic email lists, that often one has to shed a lot of digital ink, sort of reiterating what one's work is, when the hope is that you can simply send them a copy of the book, which they often refuse to receive. So it's kind of, in a sense, it's a losing battle, which is maybe a source of some frustration. But if there's any way that the process can go forward, I will try to work with what's being offered.
And we've been here with John Major Jenkins, author of Maya Cosmogenesis 2012, as well as a few other books, discussing the 2012 MEM in answer to Professor John Hupp's podcast number 4 here on Gnostic Media last about 3 weeks ago. John, thank you so much for coming on, and maybe we can do this again sometime. And did you have any closing statements or anything that you'd like to say before we go?
Noel, I just really appreciate what you're doing, Jan. I think it's very, very important. It's very much filling a vacuum in providing a forum for these ideas. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And would you like to plug your website, books, anything else that you would like people to check out?
Well, just as a resource for information, my website does have a lot of freely available articles and links and so on. It's alignment2012.com, and that is a place where one can read a lot of the background material and other assessments and so on.
And what would you tell readers is your most important or most academic work that you would like the more critical readers to check out and focus on?
I think that the book Maya Cosmogenesis 2012 is the one that does indeed have all the arguments and citations, and there's probably a few chapters in there that I would remove from another edition of it. There are several sort of ideas in there that I would consider to be sort of philosophically speculative. In a sense, that's pretty patently clear to the reader when you're reading it, but 90% of the book is an attempt to put this whole reconstruction on the table for rational thinkers.
And would you encapsulate very quickly which ideas you would remove?
Oh, well, there's some speculative, sort of almost fun kind of stuff around modern prophets that are saying things about 2012. It should have been a lot more critical, but it was sort of a survey of some things that Barbara Hand Clow said and Terence McKenna said. And there's this one idea that's in there that I sort of just almost put out there as a sort of a fanciful sort of thing, and it has to do with the Aztec idea that the end of the world would be triggered when the Tzitzimime, the demons that descend from the sky, would come down. And this is just some kind of apocryphal, almost folktale kind of thing, and I put it in there, and I've gotten more response on that one thing than probably any of the other original pioneering ideas that I put down in that book. So just for the sheer desire to not have to have dealt with responding to questions about the Tzitzimime, I probably would have removed that.
Anything else?
Well, I don't really, there's always a few typos and things like that. I have wanted to get a fair hearing on the theory that I put forward, and I've engaged in some very, serious consideration of critiques and counter critiques, and from my vantage point in having engaged with scholars on some of these on my theory, I don't see any need for revision of it. And I say that from the vantage point of having really tested it and thought hard about it, more so than even my critics. And I just do not see that it fails a rational investigation. In fact, if anything, in the subsequent years since that book came out, we have more evidence that has come to light that suggests, that basically contributes to the veracity of my work. For example, the book was called Maya Cosmogenesis, 2012. I'm told by Jeff Stray that it was the first book that had 2012 in the title, but more importantly, my use of the term cosmogenesis put something on the table that we might sort of take for granted now, but it emphasizes the idea that in the Maya thinking, cycle endings were about transformation and renewal. I never ever have promoted the idea that 2012 is about the end of time or the end of the calendar or a cataclysmic end of the world. And I simply don't see that in the Maya material.
And I should point out that that was my mistake in putting you with Coleman and Pinchbeck and Jay Wiedner and the others in podcast number 4, so I apologize for that.
Oh, well, it happens. But the interesting thing that's come out now is the existence of Tortuguero Monument 6, which Dr. Hupps alluded to. And there's, what this monument provides for us, there's actually more to that monument that was let on. On the monument, there's a deity named Bolon Yokte that is present on that monument. And this is the monument that points us right to December 21st of 2012 and tells us something about what the classic Maya were thinking about 2012. The fact that this deity Bolon Yokte is present, well, he's also present on these other monuments that involve the creation mythology. They're called creation monuments. And so this deity seems to be present during cosmogenesis events. And for years and years and years, my assumption that the Maya believed 2012 would be a kind of rebirth has been wildly criticized. And so now here we have evidence from Tortuguero Monument 6 that indeed 2012 was thought to be a kind of rebirth or genesis or cosmogenesis. So again, there's more information coming out, as well as the work of Barbara McLeod and Michael Groff that I mentioned earlier, that is providing a better groundwork and context for understanding my theory.
I would I'll wrap it up with this, and I would suggest again that sounds like another good topic that you could publish an academic article on. John, thank you so much for coming on the show, and as I said, hopefully we can do this again.
I would very much like to do that. I hope it's part of an ongoing sort of ongoing discussion that happens. So thank you so much for providing the venue.
About a week after my original interview with John Major Jenkins, he contacted me back and notified me that he had forgotten to discuss a couple of points that Hups had brought up in the original interview. So I am giving John the chance again with this short addendum to cover those points. John?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. I think that when I thought back over, I had really wanted to address these two points and, you know, just didn't get around to doing it. So.
Well, the stage is yours right now, so go ahead.
All right. Well, I did want to address two other critiques that John Hups had made regarding the 2012 question. And, of course, 2012 is the 13 Bakhtun cycle ending in the Maya long count calendar, but I've put forward the notion that we can look to the Maya creation myth, the Popol Vuh, for some kind of understanding in regards to what the ancient Maya had thought about cycle endings, because in the Popol Vuh you have a description of the world ages, the succession of ages that humanity passes through, and the inference that I make is that the 13 Bakhtun cycle in the long count calendar is a world age. And it's basically equivalent conceptually to the world ages that are described in mythological terms in the creation myth, the Popol Vuh. So one of the critiques that John Hubs had made is a statement that the Popol Vuh was translated by Francisco Jimenez around the year 1700. And we do know that the original Quiche manuscript was written down in a kind of Latinized script just after the conquest, in fact, about in the 1550s. Now, the implication from Hupp's comment is that we can't recover the original document from the 1550s because what we have from Jimenez is simply his Spanish translation of it, and it's probably filled with all kinds of errors and so on. But one problem with this critique is that, yes, Jimenez did translate the original document around 1700, and he translated into it into a kind of contemporary Spanish. But the fact is that he also copied the original document. So there is a literal copy of that Quiche Latinized original document. And in fact, this is noted in the various translations of the Popol Vuh, including the early Recenos Götz Morley translation, as well as Dennis Tedlock's translation. In fact, Dennis Tedlock used the original copy that Jimenez had made, which is preserved in the Newberry Library in Chicago, as his primary translation reference. So the supposition that Jimenez wanted to craftily adapt or change the Maya myths is proven incorrect by Jimenez's own words. And in his foreword to his second translation of the manuscript, he laments over the lack of accurate information about the ancient history of the Indians because they hid their books and those that were known were impossible to read. And he complains that, and this is a direct quote from Jimenez, quote, "Much has been imagined about these various peoples and their origins." And he continues, "And so I determined to transcribe word for word all of their tales and transcribe them into our Spanish language from the Quiche language in which I found they had been written. I decided to put here and transcribed all of their histories according to the way they had written them." So clearly, Jimenez, this indicates an interest in preserving the original sense of the document. There's no indication of a motivation for injecting, you know, Christian doctrine into the story. And in fact, he says that this work of mine attempts to give information on the errors which they had in their paganism and which they still adhere to among themselves. In other words, he has no interest in sort of whitewashing and adapting the original Maya beliefs to make them seem more Christian or something. In fact, like a good heresiologist, in which he's exposing the heresy of the pagans, his intention is to accurately report the errors of the pagan faith rather than whitewash them. Now, this is a common thing. I mean, we have the Christian writer Origen accurately reporting the Gnostic teachings. He's doing that to expose their doctrinal errors, and therefore he unwittingly preserved them accurately for future study. So it's quite clear what Jimenez was doing, and any typos or mistranslations that we may attribute to Jimenez are thus more likely to be incidental, and many of these were noted and corrected by Dennis Tedlock in his 1985 translation of the Popol Vuh by referencing Jimenez's direct copy of the original Quiche text. So I think it's important for this critique to sort of be put in its proper place, that we consider it important, and it's important to let it be known that a copy of the original manuscript exists, rather than giving the impression that we have no reference point for the original and that Jimenez made all kinds of mistakes which we can never correct, or that he intentionally added Christian beliefs.
Could I could I interject something there?
Sure.
In regards to Origen, I'm actually having John Lamb Lash on the show here in a couple weeks, who is a writer on the Gnostics, and he does challenge all of the supposed Gnostic teachings and how they're portrayed. So that's interesting that you would bring that up, because I think what he brings to the table will be interesting in juxtaposition to that specific point, but it may not apply at all to Ricenos.
So what is the supposition there, that Origen was somehow adapting or otherwise missed?
Well, from Lash's presentation, we the basic orthodox assumption is that the Gnostics were a late Christian, out of Christianity manifestation. And there's a lot of information from him, and John Allegro argued the same, as of several other scholars, that the Gnostics were pre-Christian and not the other way around, and that some of the sex rites and things like that that are portrayed about them, and they're supposedly eating babies and things like that, are completely falsified.
Well, sure, that's understandable. There would be an interest in amplifying, at least from Origen's position, there'd be an interest in amplifying the debaucheries of the faith that he wishes to discredit. And also, I do know that in the case of early Christianity, there was an interest in trying to minimize the appearance that Christianity was adopting any of the pagan beliefs. Which clearly Christianity was doing. I mean, for example, placing Jesus' birth on the same birthday that
December 25th. Yeah.
Right, right.
I think most of
I think we have a difference.
I was going to say, I think most of the listeners are probably familiar with those aspects, because I cover that so much in my own work.
Sure. Well, I think we have a different, totally different sort of historical and cultural setting going on in that situation, but I think my point still remains that heresiologists are not interested in making the pagan faith that they're criticizing appear to be more like their own faith. And that is one of the critiques against, like, for example, in some of the discussions I've had with John Hoops, there's a sense that he's giving that, well, maybe Jimenez, and when he was editing and translating the original document, was sort of injecting Christian beliefs into it. And that just absolutely makes no sense, especially from the vantage point that the point in question is the presence in the Popol Vuh of a world age doctrine. That's my main point with this, that the Popol Vuh contains a pre-conquest era world age doctrine. And to think that the Christian commentators or friars would inject a world age doctrine into the Popol Vuh is just absolutely ridiculous, considering the fact that there really is no world age doctrine that comes to us from Christianity. So, well, the second thing that I wanted to address is this scenario that Dr. Hupps had sketched, that the galactic alignment today cannot be seen. And this is because the position of the December solstice sun in the sky will be in alignment with the dark rift in the Milky Way. And so it will be obscured. This critique I've encountered going back to the time when Dennis Tedlock had asserted this to me back when we met in 1995. And at the time, I was quite surprised that he would consider such a critique to be relevant. My response to this is that, like, according to my theory, the convergence of the solstice sun and the dark rift would have been noted some 2,100 years ago by tracking the slowly converging distance between the dark rift looming over the pre-dawn solstice horizon and the soon-to-dawn December solstice sun. At that time, they were 30 degrees apart. So I propose that an interest in the future convergence developed at that time, which led to the calculation of precession and a target point for the future convergence that became formalized as the 13 Bakhtun cycle ending date in 2012. So I don't see any reason at all why the fact that the solstice sun in our era will obscure a visual recognition of the dark rift in the Milky Way, and that this suffices as a relevant critique of the proposed scenario. You know, my model does not require that we today can see the alignment. The model requires that ancient sky watchers could note and extrapolate the future convergence. So, you know, whether they were able to do this or could not do that remains to be accepted, but the critique itself does not have anything to do with what may or may not have been observed 2,100 years ago. So it doesn't logically follow as a valid critique. So those are kind of the two main things that I needed to sort of clarify.
Okay, great. And I appreciate you notifying me about that, and I think it's important for you to clarify those points too. And I was kind of surprised when I went back through the recording and listened that you hadn't, or noted that you hadn't done that. So I'm glad that you followed up with me so that we could put this in as an addendum. So thank you for doing that.
I appreciate the opportunity, Jan. I really do. I had those three things on my list, and the first one that I launched into right away just kind of led my thoughts off in different directions, so I didn't end up returning to my list. And I've been so crazy busy lately. I've been, you know, traveling quite a bit. I just got back and wanted to sort of address that. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
You're welcome.